Welcome to the Soul Science Nutrition Podcast, where you'll discover that when it comes to your health, you're so much more powerful than you've been led to believe. And now, your host. She's a holistic nutrition and lifestyle coach, chef, author, and yogi, Christine Okazie.
Hello, and welcome to the Soul Science Nutrition Podcast. I'm Christine Okazie. Thanks so much for being here. Today's episode shines the light on a whole new way to understand compulsive overeating, and that's through the lens of food addiction. Research suggests something more complex might be going on with some modern foods that we're eating that affect the brain's reward system similarly to the way addictive drugs do. So while food addiction is not officially recognized as an eating disorder, it is receiving increasingly more attention as a serious problem that many people struggle with. We know that people overeat and struggle with excess weight for many reasons. And just like some who drink alcohol or smoke marijuana, not everyone becomes addicted. Nonetheless, the distinction of food addiction is an important one because it directly relates to treatment. Because when addiction is the underlying cause of obesity, traditional treatment with diets that rely on personal responsibility or willpower or even lifestyle changes can have minimal effects. So in this case, the root cause of overeating and obesity goes unaddressed unless the underlying addiction is treated. Because food stimulates the reward center in the brain, many psychologists believe it must be treated in the same way as any other addiction. Well, today's guest is a visionary and leader in the field of food addiction. She is Susan Pierce Thompson, PhD, Adjunct Associate Professor of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at the University of Rochester, and an expert in the psychology of eating. Susan is a best-selling author with three books: Bright Line Eating, The Science of Living Happy, Thin, and Free, the official Bright Line Eating cookbook, Weight Loss Made Simple, and her newest book, Resume, the powerful reframe to end the crash and burn cycle of food addiction. Susan is president of the Institute for Sustainable Weight Loss and CEO of Bright Line Eating Solutions, a company dedicated to helping people achieve long-term, sustainable weight loss by showing you how to rewire your brain and break the yo-yo diet cycle. Bright Line Eating is geared toward those who are susceptible to addictive foods and have struggled for way too long to find peace and sanity around food. The program is grounded in psychology and neuroscience, and she uses cutting-edge research to explain how modern processed foods impact the addiction centers of our brain. But Bright Line Eating is more than just a way of eating. It's a movement. Their incredibly close-knit online support community is the core of their program, providing outreach and the human connection essential to success. Thousands of people from more than 60 countries have participated in this information-packed online course, and their community is growing by tens of thousands each month. To learn more, please visit her website, susanpiercethompson.com/brightlineeating. This was such an amazing conversation. Susan is a wealth of information and has built this program from personal lived experience and a ton of research. She's the real deal, folks, not another gimmick here. So I hope you enjoy the conversation and that you'll explore more about Bright Line Eating if you or someone you know is struggling what might be more of a food addiction than anything else. And please, I'd love to hear from you. So if you could visit Apple Podcast and leave a rating and review, I'd be grateful. And if you haven't already hit the subscribe button, please do so you don't miss an episode. Thanks so much for being here, folks, and enjoy the episode.
Hello, Susan. So good to meet you. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Christine. So great to be here with you. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. So before we get into your amazing book and all that is about Bright Line Eating, I'd like if we could just start at the beginning, you know, and kind of walk us through maybe when your struggle with addiction first began and how ultimately that became the path for you to develop the food as addiction model that became Bright Line Eating.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know, Christine, maybe I was addicted really, really young. I don't know. I know I had really addictive patterns already by the age of 9 or 10. I didn't start doing drugs until I was 14, and drugs were my first, you know, mega addiction. But I know at the age of 10, I had discovered that I loved raw cookie dough. So I was binging on that. My mom would be out of the house and I would make myself a batch of raw cookie dough and eat it and then clean it up before she got home. Okay. I had discovered masturbation and I was masturbating compulsively. Mm-hmm. And I was in a really addictive procrastination binge study cycle. Like I was a straight A student, but I had these goals of like, I was going to, you know, this semester I was going to stay up on all my reading and I was going to read the biology textbook, you know, every Monday and then highlight on Tuesday. And I had these goals. I would never do any of it. Instead, I would like zone out on TV and eat and masturbate. And then like right before the test, I would study really hard and I'd ace everything. And so I got like totally reinforced for the cycle. But anyway, I found drugs when I was 14. I was overweight at that point. Okay. And drugs helped me lose weight and I discovered boys and I started partying and it was just on from there. So the drugs started off as psychedelics and pot and alcohol. And then when I was 16, I found crystal meth and got hopelessly addicted to that. That led to me dropping out of high school and a lot of psychosis and scary stuff. And then I quit crystal meth, but quickly found cocaine and then started freebasing the cocaine and then started smoking crack. And so I ended up as a prostitute at the age of 19 and, a high school dropout and living in and out of the crack house. And there was a stretch of time where I didn't have a key to a place that I lived. And so when I was 20 years old, I walked out of the crack house. I made a resolve that I was going to quit. And I walked out and by a fluke that night, now you can't make this stuff up. That night, this cute guy that I'd met at a gas station at 3 a.m. earlier that week, took me to a 12-step meeting for drug and alcohol recovery on our first date. He was with me because he was a sex addict and he knew I was a call girl. He had 4 years of sobriety and he took me to this meeting and I got a 24-hour coin and I never looked back. And so I'm coming up on 28 years clean and sober now in just a few days. And thank you, God. Oh my gosh. So then the food addiction took off worse. Anyway, that's beautiful. How the addiction sort of blossomed and emerged and I found recovery. So I've been working the 12 steps for, you know, a long time now.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You know, so it's interesting. Looking back, you can see the sort of the compulsive tendencies that were already running and it became, you know, whatever intersection, you know, it became. So the food, actually interesting. So it sounded, food was always kind of a little kind of obsessive.
Food was always in the mix. I didn't have any angst about my eating until later. Like I didn't care, you know, I was pretty normal weight. Like I wasn't teased for being fat or anything. Mm-hmm. By the age of 14, I cared about my weight. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was eating addictively, but it wasn't torturous like it became later.
Okay. And it became a substitute it took up the space of the other substances.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I mean, really that fast. Like as soon as I put down the drugs, food just swooshed in to take its place for sure. Mm-hmm. And I got fat really fast. Like I packed on weight really fast.
Okay.
And so I was obese, I guess. I hit obesity sometime in my early to mid 20s. Okay.
And so what was your familiarities with the 12-step process that was for the recovery around the alcohol and the drugs? How did it sort of impact or maybe inform you, you know, if this approach might also be useful to help you with the addiction around food? Was there some kind of intersection there?
Absolutely. So within a few months, I think in my first year being clean and sober, I was just, you know, in meetings for drug addicts talking about food and on the one hand, people were like, well, at least you're not smoking crack anymore. You know, I wouldn't worry about those cookies so much, you know. And then on the other hand, I was talking about it a lot and someone said, you know, there's meetings for that. And so I did. I marched myself down to a food 12-step meeting. Mm-hmm. I didn't find a lot of relief there, you know, and I think the difference is that there wasn't a lot of clarity in those particular meetings mm-hmm. around what the first bite was. You know, there wasn't unity around that. There was no food plan given to me. It was sort of like, well, find a sponsor who has what you want and ask them how they did it. And so I kept eating sugar for a long time. Then once I got rid of sugar, it was still artificial sweeteners and it was flour. And, you know, so I spent eight and a half years in that 12-step food program before I found a more rigid or clear or defined, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call it, 12-step food program. And there's many. I mean, just for our listeners, if you don't know, there's at least 7 or 8 12-step food programs with significant membership right now. Okay. There's sort of the main one, Overeaters Anonymous, that no longer gives out any sort of food plan guidance. And then there's all these other offshoot ones that most of them were created to provide more clarity about what to eat and what not to eat. And when I finally fell in with a group that really had a lot of clarity about what to eat and not eat, that's when I lost my excess weight. And that's really when my food recovery journey really started. And that was when I was 28 years old back in 2003.
Okay.
And that was the seed of what became Brightline Eating for sure. I mean, that's where not the whole program, but the bulk of the program comes from for sure.
Right. What was working for you? What was the, you know, the catalyst for you to finally shift? Okay. So before we dive into that, I'd like to understand, so how would someone discern whether or not they have a food addiction?
Great question. So you can take a quiz. Oh, that's the easiest way. It's mm-hmm. 5 simple questions. You go to, oh my gosh, foodfreedomquiz.com, foodfreedomquiz.com.
Great.
So if you go to foodfreedomquiz.com, you'll be asked questions like, do you have cravings? You know, cravings for specific foods that lead you out of your way to satisfy them. When you start eating, do you sometimes lose control over how much you eat? Like you intend to eat one piece of pizza, but you have way more than that. You intend to have a small dish of ice cream and then you finish the container, the carton, right? Mm-hmm. So do you lose control over how much you eat? When you have a regular amount of food, a moderate amount of food, a traditional amount of food, do you not really feel satisfied? Mm-hmm. Do you binge? Mm-hmm. And are you spending more time thinking about what you've eaten or not eaten, what's on your plan or off your plan, how many miles, how many calories, how many pounds? Are you spending more time thinking mm-hmm. about all that than feels reasonable or desirable, right? Is it basically, do you have a lot of food obsession? Are you hounded in your mind by what we call food chatter or just, the thoughts about it all, right? I mean, we haven't sort of fast forwarded through my life, but later in my life, I ended up teaching a college course on the psychology of eating for many, many years. And I used to do this exercise where I would draw a big circle on the board and I would say, this is a pie chart, right? And this circle represents all of your life focus, what you think about, what you do, what your intentions are, where your energy is going. And I want you to draw the pie chart, draw the piece that represents how much of that is dedicated to your food, your weight, your, if you're using exercise to control your eating or whatever, all of that, like how much of that is in there. And I would see, average weight, not overweight gals in my class burst into tears at this question. And I would check in with them, seems like you're having quite a reaction to this. And what's going on for you? And they would say, 95%. So, that's food addiction. It doesn't have to go along with excess weight. As a matter of fact, my research shows that 22% of people, and Ashley Gearhart, who's done a bunch of research in food addiction, shows a very similar percentage, 19% of people at a normal BMI test out as full-blown food addicts.
This is really key. This is really key. So it's not about the weight being the key indicator. It's mindset. And it's the compulsion begins within sort of our mental, our mental processes, right? So it's important. Yeah. It's that obsessive quality. It's disruptive on the outside, clearly, because it might interfere with relationships and obligations and life. But it is very much wrapped up in our internal world, this
right.
feeling. So I think we do know, right? We know how draining it can be. We know how depleting it can be when we're hyper-focused, I guess I can say, on food and issues around food. Because it's interesting, there are a lot of those qualities, you know, who doesn't have cravings, you know, who doesn't kind of worry about, you know, what they look like or, you know, how they're going to lose weight. Everybody wants to lose that 10, 15, 20 pounds, right? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, I think, to be able to discern, you know, the degree of food obsession, right?
Yeah.
It's a spectrum. I mean, but it requires, I think, some good, you know, reflection. And I like the fact that, you know, when you bring up the food as addiction model, it's very confronting. I mean, like you said, women burst into tears, right? Because it's very confronting. It's like, okay, you know, it's kind of because it's also socially acceptable to be obsessed with food. And this is what's an interesting thing.
Oh my gosh, it
right?
so is. It like, so is. Yeah, our society is off the hook with it. But I want to say not everyone is affected. Like when you say who doesn't have cravings, there are people who don't have cravings, right?
Yeah.
My research shows about 1/3 of people just aren't addicted to food at all. As a matter of fact, they're not addicted to anything. They're not susceptible to addiction at all. That's not how their brains work. So when people say everyone's addicted to something, what they really mean is everyone's got some bad habits or whatever, but not everyone is addicted to something. 1/3 of people have brains that they don't wire for addiction. And so those folks, they'll say things like, well, you know, there's foods that I like, but I don't have cravings for them. Like I would never, you know, rearrange my evening to go get them. Or, you know, I might think, oh, it might be nice to go eat blah, blah, that place. But if my spouse says, no, I'd rather eat there, I don't care really, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting because not everyone is saddled with a brain that wires for addiction. And 1/3 of people are moderately susceptible to food addiction. And 1/3 of people are highly susceptible to food addiction, to the pull of those addictive foods. So
fascinating. Fascinating. Thank you. And so you went on the journey with, you know, to understand the cognitive and the neuroscience behind addiction, you know, and to discover all these things. So talk to us about that. Like what were your, you know, how did that inform, again, we'll get into the bright line eating, the neuroscience piece, like how did that make sense for you? How was that an empowering place to work around changing these habits?
Yeah, totally. Well, I, after I got clean and sober, I went back to school. I had been a good student in grade school and high school, you know, I got derailed because of the drugs. So thank God for the community college system. You know, I went to San Jose City College in San Francisco, in San Jose, in the Bay Area. And did well, transferred to UC Berkeley. And as soon as I transferred to UC Berkeley, I needed to pick a major. And I literally sat down cross-legged on the floor and flipped through the massive catalog, the course catalog. And I was like, art, architecture, biology, you know, just flipping through the majors. And I got to the C's and I got to cognitive science. And I read about this interdisciplinary major studying the mind and the brain from all sorts of different directions, you know, philosophy and linguistics and computer science and artificial intelligence and neuroscience and psychology. And I was like, oh yeah, this is me. So I majored in cognitive science. A couple years later, 4.0s, spoke at the graduation, was not anywhere near done. I was so on fire with this. And I applied to graduate schools and got into every graduate school, turned down Johns Hopkins and UC San Diego, which had top programs, and the University of Rochester had one of the best programs in the world.
Awesome.
And I visited it, and it just lit me up so bright. And so I moved out to Rochester, New York. That's where I still live now. And I still have an appointment actually at the University of Rochester in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences. And in 5.5 years, I had a master's and a PhD. I did a 2-year postdoc in psychology in Sydney, Australia at the University of New South Wales. And I spent 18 years, I can't remember if it was 16 or 18 years, something like that, as a psychology professor teaching and doing research at colleges and universities around the world.
Wow.
And got tenure and all that. And really, it wasn't until I started teaching two courses in particular, positive psychology the science of happiness and flourishing and well-being and the science around that, and the psychology of eating, that and the neuroscience of food addiction, that the sort of over the Venn diagram overlap of those two fields, like that's where my passion is. And so I taught those both of those courses for, you know, year upon year upon year. And it was during that stretch of time that the impulse for Brightline Eating was born in my morning meditation one morning. That was January 26th, 2014. In my morning meditation, what came was write a book called Brightline Eating. And it was just to write a book explaining why people can't lose weight, how their brains are hijacked by the, you know, ultra processed foods in our current food environment. Yes. And how to recover, like what's going on when you keep intending to eat one way and then breaking your promise to yourself and eating another way. There is a neuroscientific explanation for that strange willpower gap that exists. And so that's what that book is about. And that was the birth of Brightline Eating.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. I love that. Such an important gateway for you, right? To really bring it all together and live your expertise and practice it in a way that actually is supportive probably for your own evolution and then getting to share it. So very powerful. So what are the main principles of Brightline Eating and how does it differ most distinctively from the dieting mindset? You know, because it's quite strict. It's very specific, you know, and the structure is a big part of it. But how does it differ from that dieting mindset of willpower and deprivation?
Yeah, great question. Yes, Brightline Eating is very strict. It's very structured. So bright lines are clear, unambiguous boundaries that you just don't cross. So for example, a lot of people would relate to if you smoke 2 packs a day and you want to be a non-smoker, at some point you got to put up a bright line for cigarettes. You're just not going to smoke not a puff of a cigarette.
Got it.
And that's an empowering choice, right? In Brightline Eating, we don't have bright lines against any whole real foods. The bright lines are against the processed foods that hit the brain like drugs. It's not a keto plan or a low carb plan. We don't eat sugar and flour, but we eat apples and brown rice and like we eat all foods. And it's in terms of macronutrient, it's a very balanced plan. You can do it keto if you want, right? You can just change your categories and quantities to have more fat if you want. There's nothing against that in Brightline Eating. It's just that the bright lines are for sugar, flour, meals, and quantities. So you're so no sugar, no flour. That includes artificial sweeteners. It includes honey. Whole fresh real fruit is fine, but not fruit juice or dried fruit. Those are too much
concentrated.
Like sugar. Just too concentrated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in terms of meals, usually 3 meals a day with nothing in between, but could be 2 or 1 if you want to. You know, if you want to do intermittent fasting or whatever, but you're eating meals, you're not grazing or snacking. So you're really clear about what's not your time to eat, like what's not your food to eat and what's not your time to eat. And what all that does is a few things. It creates automaticity. We can get into that later, but I want to answer your direct question around diet mentality. The fourth bright line is quantities. There's the beginning of the difference with diet mentality. People are stunned by how much we're telling them to eat. So yes, we have you weigh it on a digital food scale, but I promise you it's mostly because you won't eat enough otherwise. You'll be thinking you're on a diet and you'll be eating too little.
Exactly.
So the quantities of food are voluminous and bountiful and abundant and colorful. You have to eat a lot of food when you're eating whole real food. And in particular, vegetables.
Yes.
People just won't eat enough. I mean, unless you're coming from the whole food plant-based world, then you'll probably be someone who eats enough vegetables naturally, but most people will not. So
agreed.
There's one of the differences is the portions are just way larger than anyone who's thinking they're on a diet.
Great.
Another thing is you're doing it for life. This is not something that you're about to transition off of. Like this is what you're doing for life. Maintenance is something we focus on a lot. And it's something we emphasize is the lifelong maintenance issue. We really teach people how to lose their excess weight and then transition to maintenance and then live at maintenance lifelong.
Yes.
And we've got courses around that and a full roadmap for guiding someone all the way to their bright body and living their long term. Mm-hmm. And so when you think of it that way, I think the difference between a diet and a lifelong identity is a lifelong lifestyle, right? The difference is identity. You become someone who does this. I don't eat sugar and flour like vegetarians don't eat meat.
Right. Right. It's not I'm dieting, I'm restricting. It's an empowered choice around eating foods that serve me and eliminating those that don't.
And exactly.
A very deep awareness to that. And so you mentioned it's a lifelong endeavor, right? No quick fix, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not necessarily weight centric, right? I'm guessing it's really more along habits and the structure and nourishment.
I mean, we talk about weight because a lot of people come and want to lose weight. And
sure.
I think that's fine. I think that if someone has noticed their knees are hurting, I think there's all kinds of empowered reasons to want to lose weight. And I 100%. Think that there's all sorts of unhealthy reasons to want to lose weight too. And it's probably pretty hard in this society to tease them apart, to be honest.
Good point, you know, and so that's where I'm wondering. So in the thousands of folks that have participated in Brightline Eating, there's this emotional component, because we all know at the root of addictive, you know, behaviors, unwanted habits, you know, compulsive behaviors, it's not a willpower muscle that we're relying on. We have to get underneath and look at sort of the attitudes, the conditioning, there's trauma, there's unresolved emotion. So how have you, given the psychology of eating and the positive psychology, how have you weaved that into Brightline Eating? How do you make sure that folks are not coming in with that, well, I just need to eat this and everything will be okay? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Well, what'll happen with those folks is they'll stick with their Brightlines for a little while in a honeymoon period, and then they'll realize what they were eating over in the past, right? Like their emotions will come knocking. Yes. And what will happen is one meal at a time, one day at a time, they'll have the opportunity to address the underlying issues, right? There's an old saying, right? Don't worry about getting in touch with your feelings. Your feelings will get in touch with you, right?
Okay.
So as soon as you're living by the bright lines and, you know, using food as a coping mechanism isn't an option anymore, you're going to have to address the underlying stuff. And the way we support people with that is with a method called internal family systems. So IFS. And internal family systems is a branch of psychology that's just taken off lately because it's super evidence-based. It's incredibly helpful and it's powerful. I've been a psychology professor for a lot of years and I know a lot about a lot of modalities, and this is an unusually targeted, effective one for changing unwanted behaviors and healing on the deepest levels inside, the deepest, oldest stuff. And it's IFS also has a model of the human psyche, like who we are as human beings, that I think is the most helpful model I've ever come across in my life. So we teach people IFS and we teach people how to heal and how to understand the parts of themselves that seem to be sabotaging their progress or want to take them off the rails. Like why, what is that part afraid of? What is it wanting? Yes. What's its perspective? You start listening to those parts of you that you used to just try to push away or squelch or silence. You get curious and you start to listen to them. And then ultimately you start to heal them.
I love it. Yeah. It's a very powerful system. So thank you for sharing that. And I think that maybe we can pivot into your latest book, which is Resume, which actually talks about, you know, that crash and burn cycle and the ups and downs, right? So tell us, you know, what was the inspiration behind that? Is that, you know, kind of the next phase? Because your Brightline Eating was really around the structure and the food and all of, you know, that goes with the activity, the practice. Tell us about that. What is that powerful reframe that you talk about in your new book to end that crash and burn cycle?
So Resume came out of a 4-year period of time where after starting Brightline Eating, you know, when I started Bright Line Eating, I hadn't eaten sugar or flour myself in, you know, a decade or more, right? I was really doing this myself for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then I started Bright Line Eating, and a couple years in, I broke my Bright Lines. And then I couldn't stop breaking my Bright Lines on and off, on and off, on and off for four yes. years.
Okay.
And because I had to keep going on camera every week, I've released a weekly vlog for, you know, 7 or 8 years now. I couldn't gain significant weight. You know, I had to keep my eating at least in check enough to not gain weight. Otherwise I couldn't, you know, function in the world. Right. And so what happened was the pressure to not gain weight, butted up against the, force of my food addiction, which had been released again inside me. I was nowhere near neutral with my food for most of that time. And I got more experience breaking and resuming and breaking and resuming during those 4 years than I would wish on any living human being. It was quite torturous. But what happened was, coming out of that 4 year period, I did a lot of deep inner healing work. And that is the work that is presented in Resume, this internal family systems work. And I also realized at some point, you know, the cycles of life keep happening, you know, where we sort of get it together a bit and things feel okay. And then it all feels like it's falling apart and life gets lifey and we're struggling and we're behind the eight ball and it's hard. And then we kind of, you know, get it together again, a little life feels okay. And it's just the sine wave of life. It goes up and down. And what I realized is that that's always going to happen. And if you think of a relapse, you think of the word relapse, lapse again. Again, a period of time where things feel like they've lapsed. And whether that's your habits of meditation and your morning routine and whatnot, or whether it's your food and it's starting to get wonky or, you know, worse, what I realized is the difference between the cycles I was experiencing and what it was like when I wasn't breaking my Bright Lines was really more a matter of degree than a it wasn't like I never used to lapse. I did. I would just not crash all the way down into all out binging and, you know, hand over fist weight gain again. And so what I teach people to do is to expect the lapse. You've got to expect it, and you've got to learn tools and strategies for course correcting as opposed to staying perfect.
That's right.
That's okay. Mainly the reframe is awesome. You're always course correcting.
It's life, right?
I mean, it's life. Yeah.
Every exactly. aspect but, of your life. Yeah.
But I think us food people, we tend toward perfectionism, right? And the mindset is that we're going to get it perfect and keep it perfect at some
That's
point.
Right. All or nothing.
And with a Bright Line approach, that can make that expectation worse, right? That you're going to get it perfect and keep it perfect. But there are a lot of people who don't deviate from their food plan when they lapse. They just catch it early enough. They lapse with their support or their habits, and they notice that, and they just get good at course correcting before it affects their food.
Very powerful reframe and really important because, you know, addressing that perfectionism, that all or nothing approach is really important. And when it comes to, you know, what I'm getting is the Bright Line Eating approach helps you get, I tend to use is getting your biology on your side. You know, so when you start to shift the quality of your food, you bring awareness to this thing that we do, you know, called eating. It balances you out on a physiological level that allows us to then look at, as you, to your point, the emotions, the psychology, you know, the underlying, you know, non-physical components that are driving those unwanted habits. And then together, we're able to stay a little bit more in, you know, in balance, right? But to your point, once, if our physiology is not under control, if the sugar, the flour, the things that you said are hijacking our you know, our nervous system, our biology, right? It makes it that much more difficult, if not altogether really impossible, to do that deeper work, which is so important. So I like the combination of the two, because it's not one without the other, right? And different diet systems kind of don't bring that together. So that's what I'm getting from your program, is it's so balanced that way. It's working with the physiology, but it's also working with the underlying emotional stuff. So I just want to segue into, this is the Soul Science Nutrition Podcast, and we get into, you know, kind of the deeper kind of spiritual transformational components. I know your history, you walked a path, you were a member of the Baha'i faith for quite some time. You mentioned meditation a few times. You mentioned, you know, kind of doing deep inner work. I'm really curious for you, if you could share what role your spiritual practice, your spiritual evolution played in your journey, and how you share that or weave that maybe in into your work, you know, with clients through
yeah,
their journey.
Totally. Yes. Yeah. So I'm a 12-stepper through and through. I work the 12 steps. And the third step is surrendering your will and your life to the care of God as you understand God. Mm-hmm. And the 11th step is seeking God's will through prayer and meditation, and seeking only knowledge of God's will for you and then the power to carry that out. Mm-hmm. And then the 12th step is about service, you know, giving it back, helping other people have their transformation. And, you know, the 7th step is around asking God to remove whatever is blocking you from doing God's will, you know, your whatever, you know, sticky, you know, 7 deadly sins or, you know, shortcomings or criticism, judgment, you know, anger,
yes,
whatever the things
yes.
are, right? So it's a very spiritual approach. I was religious for 20 years, actually, to the day. I unenrolled from the Baha'i faith after 20 years. The Baha'i faith is a beautiful religion, and I had to part ways with it because of its stance on homosexuality. I just can't conscience belonging to a faith that says that someone who's gay has to pray the gay away, and can't get married, you know, can't have sex. I don't believe that. And
yes.
to be honest, Christine, I don't know how I belonged for 20 years. I mean, I never believed that piece of it. I just kind of set it on the shelf and did feel very spiritually connected, to the faith in other ways.
Yes.
But there's a lot of beauty in the Baha'i faith. And
mm-hmm.
What I teach in Bright Line Eating is meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach in terms of internal family systems, I teach about the notion of an authentic self,
yes.
not an ego self, but an authentic self, the highest self. And you know that you're coming from a place of highest self when you're manifesting the 8 C's. So you're calm, clear, compassionate, confident, connected, confident, curious, courageous. Those are the 8 C's. And when you're there, when that's the energy that you're bringing to the moment, the present moment, you're yes. in your authentic self. And if you want to take it further, you can say that's when you're connected to the divine. That's when you are the channel for the divine. That's mm-hmm. when you're manifesting the divine. That's when the divine can speak to you and through you mm-hmm. when you're in that highest self place. And
yes.
then, you know, internal family system says, if you're anything else, you know, angry, agitated, impatient, afraid, controlling, whatever, you're
mm-hmm.
you're in a part. You're not in your authentic self. There's a part of you that's manifest.
That's right.
And parts are either protective parts or wounded parts.
Right.
They're either manifesting some sort of wound or trying to protect us from being wounded or mm-hmm. trying to protect us from having just been wounded by putting out the fire of that wound, right?
Mm-hmm.
With some sort of numbing or anger or whatever.
Yes.
And so I teach people how to befriend their parts and get curious about their parts and help those parts from a place of authentic self, a place of highest self. You can sort of interact with those parts and help them to loosen their grip on however they think they need to show up in the world, often give them new roles where they can really soar and stop mucking things up.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful and extremely powerful way to relate to ourselves and to heal the wounds within how we relate to ourselves, right? Thank you. That's brilliant. Thank you so much. I think it's like, you know, the biggest missing component when it comes to changing our relationship with food, you know, and our bodies is that deeper work, that reframing, you know, that goes a long way. So thank you for that. That is brilliant.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do want to say, you know, in terms of the plan, Bright Line Eating is very similar to any of the half a dozen 12-step food programs that broke off from Overeaters Anonymous and have a more structured way of eating, like mm-hmm. Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, FA, is a mm-hmm. very structured plan. And in FA and OA and all the other 12-step programs, you work the 12 steps, right? And there are a lot of people for whom the explicit nature of that feels not like their path. It's just not their path, right? Sure. There is, you know, 12 steps are very clear that you get to define your own higher power and so forth. But a lot of the language is very patriarchal religious language.
Yes. Yes.
And it's, you know, at some point they might change that, but they haven't, right? And so it is very patriarchal and very sort of God is the Father, we are His children sort of language, yeah. right?
Exactly.
And so for people who don't want that, Bright Line Eating is an option. I would say there are a couple of other major differences between Bright Line Eating and a 12-step program like FA. One would be that Bright Line Eating is founded in science, and you're going to learn a lot of neuroscience. You're going to learn a lot of psychology. And, you know, things like the food plan change based on scientific updates, right?
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case in 12-step programs. And then the other piece is in a 12-step program, your experience is going to be heavily impacted by your sponsor. Your sponsor sort of in the stricter 12-step programs, you know, what you eat and don't eat, often even down to the nuances of how you live your life, is going to be dictated by your sponsor. And in Bright Line Eating, that's not the case. You're sort of the author of your own journey in Bright Line Eating. And so it is, and it's a big difference. And so I just want to say that the spiritual component in Bright Line Eating in particular, I teach the science, which shows that prayer and meditation are both ways to replenish willpower.
Yes.
They're both ways to overcome temptation in the moment. And then we teach this internal family systems approach, which again is based on authentic self, where if you are religious and you want to, or deeply spiritual, and you want to conceive of that authentic self as a channel to the divine, you can do that. But there's also a very obvious secular interpretation, right, of the 100%. Authentic self is essentially secular until you decide to take it to that next level. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think of, you know, in Bright Line Eating, we keep religion out of our community. Like, it's interesting. I'm at the moment redefining our group norms for our online community.
Nice.
And just checking again. And the answer is yes, we want to keep religion out, which means in your post, you can say how your faith is informing your bright day on that day or your meal or whatever, but not with a scriptural verse attached to it or a picture of religious iconography attached to it.
Sure,
you would
sure.
leave that out. And we have individuals who've created, you know, affinity groups for their religion, you
nice.
Know, where they post that there. But in the main group, we keep it religion neutral. And so that's kind of the line that we walk in Bright Line Eating, because I do think of it as a place where people who know they're food addicts and need recovery, but the 12-step approach just doesn't work for them for that, mm-hmm. you know, religious reason. I want to make sure that they feel, you know, that they feel welcome in Bright Line Eating.
Yeah. And the community aspect, I just want to highlight, is a huge component of the process and the program and the lifelong journey. And that's something
huge.
I think, again, a big missing piece, because dieting can be very isolating. You know, you tend to think that you're the only one going through what you're going through. And so tapping into that resource that you've built, this tremendous community that you've built, is such a healing resource in itself. So That's awesome.
It really is. And we have research showing that it completely changes people's lives. I mean, we did a study. We might want to talk about some of the research we've published, but because that's another thing that diets don't do is they don't publish their findings because they don't have,
because diets don't work. That's pretty much it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we published this study showing that we looked at psychosocial metrics. So we looked at levels of depression, days of bad mental health. We looked at energy levels. We looked at perceived social support. So how loved and supported are you feeling in the world? How much do you agree with a statement like, if I'm going through an emergency, I absolutely have people who would come over to my house and help, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
I think there's a couple, just overall quality of life and well-being. So we looked at these metrics and what we found is in 2 months on Brightline Eating, people experience astronomical improvements across the board on all these metrics. Yes. And we're talking huge effect sizes. But then check this out. We looked at the 3 months as COVID was coming down. I mean, April, May, and June of 2020, right? Like when we were all reeling. The people who started Brightline Eating then and did their first 2 months then compared with a comparison group from 6 months prior or 6 months later.
Okay.
Experienced that same astronomical effect, but even more so on steroids, meaning it's such a supportive environment that when it's all hitting the fan, it's there for you even more, right? Yeah. And it transforms you even more. So Brightline Eating makes people feel loved and connected and seen and supported in the world like nothing I've ever seen. These effect sizes were just astronomical.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. Thank you for that. And that's really the nexus of it, right? I mean, so again, a huge, huge contrast to, you know, diet mindset and magic bullets and all these gimmicks that are just so disempowering and isolating, to your point.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Totally. So, you know, I would love if you would take a moment and share, you know, how would you describe your relationship with food and your body these days? What's your self-care like?
Oh, what a great question. I'm in such a good groove. Oh my gosh. I'm in such a good groove. I came out of that stretch of time where I was breaking my bright lines and I haven't had sugar or flour in almost 3 years. And just a couple months ago, I tightened up sort of just my quantities in restaurants were off and wonky. And I got that really cleaned up. And I'm finally healing from a long-time shoulder injury. And I think this might be my year to do a pull-up, which is it's like the number one thing on my lifetime bucket list. I don't know I've never done one. I would love to be able to do a pull-up. So I'm working out really well and feeling strong and limber in my body. My food is really streamlined and simple and healthy. I love the way I eat and I don't think about food in between. The analogy I like to give is, my meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they're like a hot shower. Mm. I love my hot shower. I take a long hot shower. I live in a part of the country where we have plenty of water. I live right near the Great Lakes and, I take advantage, man. I take a 22 minute hot shower every day.
Wow.
And pound the music and dance. And you know, I love that time, but I'm not thinking about it before or after. There's no obsession associated with it. Okay. And there's no mental headspace or mental chatter associated with it. Sometimes I'm online enjoying it mentally while it's happening. And sometimes I'm thinking about other stuff, which is fine, but it's a fabulous pleasure. And that's how my meals are. I love them. I enjoy them, but I'm not thinking about them before or after. I have complete freedom and neutrality around my food. I eat out with my family. I travel, you know, I just took a kiddo to New York City and we saw Beetlejuice on Broadway. It was fun. Awesome. We ate out, you know, but I'm also careful in particular about how I eat. I didn't eat out every meal. I packed some of my food for that trip, you know.
There you go.
I wake up and meditate for 30 minutes every morning. I stay closely connected with people on this journey with phone calls throughout the day. And I still go to 12-step meetings because that's my grounding in this universe is I am a recovering addict through and through. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm flourishing, really firing on all cylinders. I couldn't be happier.
So beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, simply because that outcome is, you know, that freedom, that neutrality, that ability to find balance in life, right? So we're not living in a cave, you know, eating the same thing all the time. It's not a low pleasure situation, you know, super important. I've never known anyone in you know, my work to make such good strides, lasting changes by giving up the pleasure of eating and the pleasure of living, you know, and just sort of always in that, I just got to knuckle through. And so what I love about, you know, everything you stand for and share is the personal empowerment, you know, so it's not the food that has the power. It's not societal standards and norms, not even your past conditioning that has the power. It's always within you. And so it is a roadmap that you've given people. So I'm really so great to have you share that on the show. So thank you. Is there anything that maybe I, you know, didn't know enough to ask that you'd like to share right now? Maybe like the number one takeaway, you know, from your most current book.
You know, could I go back to the research and share a couple more findings?
I would love that.
Yeah. So we published a couple studies in the Journal of Nutrition and Weight Loss, scientific peer-reviewed studies, showing our weight loss results, not just initial, but 2 years later. And they are many, 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 many times greater weight loss results than Noom, Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, Nutrisystem, you name it, E-Diets, Biggest Loser, on and on and on, right? And people lose their weight in Bright Line Eating, but they keep it off. They keep it off. And we published another study showing that in the first 2 months of Bright Line Eating, not only do people lose an astronomical amount of weight, I'm talking, you know, 3, 4, 5 times more than they would lose on Noom, for example. But women who are postmenopausal and men in their 50s and 60s lose weight at the same rate, that same fast rate that people in their 20s and 30s do. And the reason, that's not the way it works out there in the big bad world. The reason is that when you stop eating sugar and flour, it doesn't matter as much how well your insulin is working and estrogen, which both men and women lose later in life, decrease later in life. Estrogen has a facilitating effect on insulin. And so when you take sugar and flour out of the equation, it doesn't matter as much whether or not you've got a lot of estrogen on board. And so that's what levels the playing field. So people on our plan lose weight well, whether they've got thyroid issues or, you know, assuming that they're getting some treatment for their thyroid issues. But I've got Hashimoto's and you know, a lot of people do, they lose their weight, whether they're, you know, 50 or 60 or 70 or 80. Mm-hmm. Another thing is that we published a study showing that hunger and cravings go down in those first 2 months, down all the way to negligible levels. So that means that people are losing weight hand over fist and they're not hungry anymore and they're not craving anymore. Yes. And that's what happens when you eat whole real food and you're not trying to shove down 1 point brownies and, you know, say, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So, you know, we're big on collecting data and publishing data in Bright Line Eating. I'm still an academic. And again, I still have a professorship at the University of Rochester and the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences. And, we try to be about as far away from the gimmicky side of the continuum as it's possible. Yeah, we don't have a line of foods. Yeah. First thing, go to the store, buy carrots.
Or 20 million supplements, right?
Or 20 million supplements. Yeah. None of that. No supplements. Yeah. No. Right. I mean, you can take supplements if you want. We're just not going to sell them to you, right?
Right. Refreshing. You know,
talk to your doctor.
Right.
Yeah. So I wanted to cover that a little. And then maybe I do have a last takeaway beyond that, but I just wanted to cover the data a little bit.
But let me ask you a question. Yeah. The part about the keeping the weight off, because this is really where the rubber meets the road. Okay, anybody can lose a bunch of weight. You know, that's not the challenge. I know there's multi factors, but when people ask you, well, what's the secret? Right? Yeah. How does that work exactly? What do you say to that? What's the most overriding, you know, peace.
Yeah. It's one thing. It's stay close to the mothership. You know, you gotta stay close because the people who wander away Bright line eating works so well that it convinces you that you're fine and you're cured and you can just go off and do it on your own. And so when you stay close, you stay a member, you stay in touch with other members, and you're still working the program, that's when you keep the results. And when you wander off on your own, you'll quickly see, oh, you know, bright line eating is powerful. So you'll probably do fine for a bit. It's really 6 months later that the paths diverge between people who stayed close and people who've wandered away. So the voice inside that says, I don't need to be a member anymore, I can go wander away and do this on my own, you will be able to for about 6 months, the research shows. And then you're going to start putting back on your weight and not doing as well. So stay close. Just keep doing it. Just keep doing it. You've probably heard the saying, insanity is trying the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Yeah. So I want to add to that. Insanity is finding what really works and then deciding to stop doing it.
Okay.
It works. So just stay. It's, you know, because it's not onerous. It's fabulous to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. So just
ongoing
stay.
Support, ongoing yeah. consistency. Really important.
Just it's like an identity said. Thing. Because when you walk away, you notice that you did. And it takes, your identity takes a hit. You think, well, I'm not really doing bright line eating anymore. And then you become someone who doesn't need to keep the bright lines. And then you become someone who makes exceptions. And then the exceptions amplify. And, you know, we attract people who are higher on the food addiction susceptibility scale, yeah. you know, that's who we attract. And so the addiction starts to take its root again. And, you know, some becomes more and more becomes a lot more sometimes. And, you know, it just takes off from there. Right. So
Thank you. Okay. That's key. So you wanted to share one more thing, sort of like,
yeah, takeaway? I know based on the data that there, you know, about 20% of the people listening to this podcast, maybe more, because the people who tune in would be more likely to be this way. There are people right now, and I just want to speak, if it's you, who really struggle with food. You know, if you're someone who eats and then feels terrible shame and remorse afterwards, who has tried everything and just never found lasting peace, I just want you to know you're not alone. You're not alone.
Yeah.
And there is hope. You can find permanent freedom one day at a time. Please give it a try. There's a free trial. Just go to brightlineeating.com and give it a try. Just awesome. 14 days. Give it a try. We would love to see you. You're so not alone. And if you don't want to try it, I just want you to know that I love you. I see you. I get it. And just my heart is with you on the path, because being someone who is saddled with food addiction is just, it's a very particular affliction. And I just want you to know you're not alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Susan, for all your wisdom and all the work that you do in the world. It's just beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks, Christine. So sweet to be with you.